Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the April 5th edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swaim, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. And you can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here. He's an economist, an author. He's the host of the Capital Record podcast and the founder of the eponymous investment firm, The Bonson Group. Hello, David.
Hello, Will. How are you, my friend?
I'm good, buddy. We have so much to talk about, but I always hesitate because you literally just jumped on here with Glenn and Brian, and they've been here for 10 minutes checking my speed. It's terrible on the, not the, you know, the download stuff. But how you doing? What you been up to?
Will, nobody cares what I've been up to. I mean, honestly, the listeners are so bored with my life. I think you care, but I don't think the listeners care. But if you must know, I am in New York and flew out on Saturday night, landed Sunday morning, and it has been absolutely beautiful out here. And it is very busy. I have a lot going on, which is very good. But, you know, going to be here a couple weeks and then back in California for a few weeks.
Remind me, what's the big time of year for you guys when you're in New York and you are doing like a series of, I don't know whether they're pitch meetings, you call them, you know, where you go and you're like meeting 3, 5, you know, 6 or 7 times a day with people?
With the money managers? That's in October every year. Yeah, I started doing that in 2006. And so that is something we do every year in October.
Got it.
Yeah, that good memory. I'm glad you remember that. That's one of my favorite weeks of the year, by the way.
So you're truly an extrovert then, right?
No, I absolutely hate people. Hate it.
Which is why you're recording this from a distance that is about the length of a Vladimir Putin conference table. David, do you mind
Do you know what an extrovert is, Will?
You're going to tell me a joke, but I think the definition is...
I'm not going to tell you a joke.
Okay. I think an extrovert is defined as somebody who is charged up by social interaction, whereas an introvert finds it draining. That's supposed to be a key feature. I'm an extrovert.
It's the key feature. It's the defining feature. So it isn't... People mistakenly think it has to do with personality or comfort level in social situations or being kind of outgoing and charismatic versus shy and whatnot. All it is someone who is filled up and energized by social dealings and human interaction versus someone who's drained by it. And when I do these events where I'm speaking to a lot of people, talking to a lot of people, if it were up to me, I'd go home after and lock the door and not talk to anyone for a month. It's almost clinical. Now, when we refer to me enjoying the money manager meetings, which I think is what catalyzed you to think I might be extroverted, these people are the furthest thing on God's earth from social interactions. It's an entirely intellectual process and very cerebral conversation with other people that are largely introverted too. And so it's almost like it's the exception that proves the rule, if you will. But then if they were to say after meetings all day, we're going to go out to the bar tonight and we're all going to be hanging out, there's a 0% chance I would ever go, ever.
Me too. Okay, so that's me. But I thought you said you were definitely an extrovert.
In textbook, introvert.
Okay, so by that definition, I'm also an introvert. Because at the end of those kinds of days, I have never been a person who enjoys big parties, for instance, or clubs or anything like that.
You're not an extrovert.
Yeah. When I played in a band, everybody else would go out and party like crazy until 5 in the morning, and I'd go home and read and fall asleep.
Yeah. Now, again, technically someone could not like partying and still be an extrovert, and, mm-hmm. and someone could like partying and be an introvert. Because it still just comes down to whether or not their cup is filled. No pun intended, like the red cup. See what I did there? But like, I think tons of people go to parties that are introvert and they drink by themselves in the corner or whatever. So those things are kind of separate categories.
Okay.
But no, the extrovert introvert thing is one that I believe people misunderstand a lot. And I will make an argument that almost all of our society is built around appeasing extroverts and that nobody really cares about the introverts
until it's COVID. Hey,
maybe I can elaborate on that sometime.
I would love for you to. We could do it right here.
Book.
I think that's a great idea.
Would you mind actually if I sign off right now and start working on this? Because I'm getting a little drained.
I've got my red cup in the corner. Yeah. Hey, April 3rd, that was Sunday. You and I are recording here on Tuesday morning. April 3rd was the anniversary of the founding of the Pony Express, April 3rd, 1860. I know you love this, but you will like this part. No John Sutters were involved in the creation of this particular little anecdote. But this is fascinating, David, and I think you will appreciate some of these features of the Pony Express. It lasted only 18 months from 1860 to 1861, and it died because of the advent of the telegraph. And yet, here's what's really fascinating to me. I won't even go into all the technology, which was really just, you know, super slim riders. In fact, as young as 14 years old, would ride these little short circuits, they called them, you know, and then you would trade off. You've seen the images, you know, a guy jumps off a pony, climbs on another fresh one, and they would ride up to 20 hours a day through the night. But here's the interesting part. The initial price of sending a message was $5 per every half ounce. And that price was 25,000% higher than the price of mail through the normal mail service. 25,000% higher. So it's one of these things where people were willing to pay the extra price to get nothing like, you know, super, I mean, it was considered super quick at the time, of course, because it could take far more than that. I mean, months for a regular letter to get from east to west. But the terminus point was in Sacramento. Started technically in St. Louis, ends up in Sacramento, and they hope to win, the founders of the Pony Express hope to win a government contract, but of course telegraph comes along and just makes all this instantly redundant. I could go on. This is my favorite part. I found this on Wikipedia, by the way. Eventually, everything except one revolver and a water sack was removed, like no food, just water and a handgun. Allowing for a total of 165 pounds, the riders could not weigh more than 125 pounds. We're talking about boys and men under 125 pounds. I haven't weighed 125 pounds since I was 14, so I find this kind of amazing. And their pouches would hold 20 pounds of mail. So anyway, to our friends in the Pony Express, whose stories are legendary and which ran from briefly 18 months from St. Louis, Missouri, through Indian country, through massive battles. You're already bored.
I'm not bored. I'm just thinking about an interesting takeaway that you haven't covered.
Please.
I bet the Pony Express in 1860, not adjusting for weather, technology, health, anything. In 1860, on an absolute basis, I bet you they delivered the mail quicker than the post office does today. And with less errors.
They had one screw up where a guy was killed, his bag was found, and the mail was delivered 2 years late. That happens. That's called, you know, a regular Tuesday at the USPS. I'm kidding, yeah, to all of our friends at the US Postal Service.
Yeah, that's actually a huge demographic of the Radio Free California listening base is postal workers. Let's do this, because I am never, ever, ever, ever soliciting feedback from listeners, you know, to my email inbox. Mm. But I would love to know, if you work for the United States Postal Service, please send us a note. And I would like to see how many emails Will gets in his inbox.
Okay, well, there's a throwdown to my letter carrier, Pete, the mailman, who listens to
us. You know how many
regularly?
Podcasts I would listen to if I worked for the post office?
Oh my gosh.
How long is the shift? Do they work 8 hours a day or longer?
I think it's at least 8 hours. Like, my guy is...
I'd get 8 podcasts a day.
Yeah, absolutely. And you listen to them at 2x speed, so...
No, I actually don't. I listen to them at the normal speed.
I listen to Charlie Cook at 2 or 3 times, but that's exclusive to Charlie.
Does that help get rid of that obnoxious accent?
No, it's just the pause. The pregnant pause. I love Charlie Cook, by the way. He's just a...
Who doesn't?
As Seinfeld might say, he's a slow talker. All right. Hey, I wanted to start with just a little bit of local/national news. Did you follow, David, the shooting in Sacramento?
I mean, it was... Yeah, I saw what happened, saw the news stories. I didn't dig super deep into it. Obviously, you know, tragedy and just... you hate to see the senseless loss of human life. You may know more though if there's updates. I'm not following it that closely.
The update today, Tuesday morning, is interesting because now it turns out that the chief suspect in the shooting is a guy who is a convicted felon who was proscribed apparently, from owning handguns of any kind, and yet somehow managed to get them. Guess what? And so, you know, the key here is that we have in California.
Hold on, Will, how did he get them if it was illegal?
The law says he can't have them, so he can't have had them.
You can't get a gun if it's illegal.
I think that's really true. And so, of course,
unless you're going to tell me that someone's going to go shooting people if that were illegal.
I think you're right. But, you know, what's weird is, you know, it's not weird. It's sort of predictable that my favorite take was from the Sacramento Bee, which in a piece by who is this? Oh, it's the editorial board. I'm sorry. Halfway down in their story, having described the horror of this event. I mean, bottom line, downtown Sacramento, right near the Capitol, like a block or two away. Nightclubs are emptying it out at 2 a.m. on Sunday morning. And club empties out and there's a fight and suddenly guns are present. And one of them is described in the Bee article as a machine gun. Now, I'm not an arms expert of any kind. But machine gun sounds like, you know, Tommy guns in World War I or something like that. I love that down here, they have sort of near the top, they say, California has the strongest gun laws in the nation, yet steps away from the Capitol were city blocks that resembled a war zone. And this irony does not seem to strike them as a moment when they might rethink their take on gun laws, which is predictably next, we have to have better gun laws. That's the problem. I've heard it turned in, you know, in a couple of other places into a kind of a social justice issue that this wouldn't happen if, in fact, the police really, you know, sort of defended black communities instead of attacking them. But it also had this weird quality.
I actually would even say this, Will. I would like to see some laws against shooting people in a nightclub.
That would be great.
Because
then it would stop.
I think that the shooting, in my view, is really pretty consistent. Going back to Columbine, you know, which was a long time ago now, that when these shooting incidents happen and there's more than one person killed in a shooting, and we've had it was a movie theater in Aurora, Colorado. It was obviously famously Columbine, the worst of all, just because of the children and their age involved with Sandy Hook. We know of the school shooting in Florida. But there's been a lot of these incidents. And in each case, I just feel very strongly because of my theology of human life and my belief about the dignity of mankind and the special vocation mankind has in his role as a created being of God, that I think we should be focusing on the tragedy, the shooting. And when one, as is the case now with Twitter and social media and the internet, in 10 seconds has turned it into some other prescribed theme. Look, I'm not wrong to picture people sitting at their screen rooting for it to have been a white supremacist, or rooting for it to have been a jihadist, or rooting for it to have been someone who you know, got a gun too easily, because they want it to fit a political narrative. And there's something dehumanizing for the victims in that instinct. And I think it's disgusting. But I also believe that, to the point you're making, most of the commentary that is atrocious is leftist commentary that lacks an understanding of human nature. The belief that if we could make it harder to get guns, that it would cut down on it, ignores the fact that we already have made it very clear that shooting those guns at people is against the law. The belief in a social framework being to blame is actually the underlying theology of the left, that man is born basically good but then becomes bad because of inadequate justice issues in the society, usually around race or class. And the really troubling counterfactual for those people is the billions of people born into bad circumstances that don't go shooting people up, for God's sake.
Is this the truth? So immediately the Sacramento Bee says, I love this. This is the classic in media. It's that we are above the fray. So you'll like this passage, I think, David. It's about halfway through their editorial. In an attempt to make sense of this tragedy, some people will prematurely project their political beliefs and personal views onto the situation, lamenting policies or practices that may have no bearing on this violent outburst. I mean, you and I agree with that. But then the Sacramento Bee goes on to say, the only thing that's consistent in these mass shootings are the weapons of war that enable them, and the inability of leaders to fulfill their promise to address the scourge of suffering in our communities. So everybody else has a political take, except for the folks at the editorial board of the Sacramento Bee and elsewhere, where I saw these similar stories, noting, on the one hand, that we've already got the most stringent gun laws in the nation, and on the other hand, this thing can still happen, and it's only because we haven't tweaked the knobs on the regulatory devices. And anybody who disagrees with that is part of the crowd that's just projecting their own beliefs. It reminds me of this book. I don't know if you ever read it. It was a German writer, kind of historian, philosopher, Karl Mannheim, who wrote a book called Ideology and Utopia. And he goes through this whole thing in this book of saying, like, look, this special interest group, you know, it's primarily Marxist in its orientation, so it's always a problem of class. But at the end, Mannheim says, look, even the Marxists aren't really right. There's only one group that can rescue us from the idiocy of small d democracy and, you know, man's savage nature under capitalism. And that's the intelligentsia, the academics, that they are like this free-floating group without class bias, without any sort of bias, in fact. And if we just had them or the folks at the Sacramento Bee, then everything would be okay. They go on to point out that, and I checked this out with a few friends who work in the Capitol, Assembly, State Senate, and a couple of staffers who tell me that already, predictably, the Democrats are rallying around Newsom's project, which is having an anti-gun bill, which Newsom says will emulate the anti-abortion bill in Texas. That is called PAGA, the Private Attorneys General Act. And you might remember this, David, that the SB8 in Texas says that their particular mechanism for enforcing Texas's new law on abortion is going to be that we're going to unleash private attorneys and citizens to make money by turning in abortionists. Newsom strikes back and says, well, if they can do that, you'll remember this. We talked about this a few weeks ago. Newsom strikes back and says, well, if Texas can do that, then we can too. And we're going to do it to stop gun violence. Newsom never acknowledges that we've had private attorneys general acts out here in California forever, and they're always aimed at the business class, particularly small business, which can't afford to defend itself and so has to settle cases on, you know, handicap access or a labor dispute involving one employee who claims to represent all employees of that business. And people make millions and millions of dollars off these private attorneys general act. In any case, my contacts, my sources up in the Capitol tell me already the Dems are out and saying, now we got to unleash this Private Attorneys General Act on guns and go after gun manufacturers. And if the Supreme Court does anything to stop that, why, then they're just hypocrites because they won't stop it in Texas. Of course, there's no constitutional right to an abortion that I can recall in any of the, 27 amendments. But there is one for guns. Number two, we call that the Second Amendment. So anyway, predictably, already turning into that kind of an argument about how we just need a little more regulation.
Yeah, so. Well, you know, it is almost a kind of rinse and repeat. This one was in Sacramento, so it's a California story. But I think that whatever they're writing about, whatever we're saying now, I think it's true of all of these incidents. I mean, these things play out constantly. And I there is something rich about a media outlet claiming that they wish people wouldn't go politicize something that they're about themselves to politicize. But I don't know. This is old hat.
Yeah.
What you know, what would be interesting is I would like to see when one of these tragic shootings happen, instead of nobody jumping to politicize it and no one doing a, like, we need legislation thing. It might be interesting if at some point the immediate response is an exhaustive commentary on a culture that has lost a regard for human life, starting in the womb and going all the way up to our most senior population, where the regard for the elderly was so high during COVID that we were denying them burials and not allowing their grandkids and grown kids to visit them in the hospital, or even attend a private health protected funeral service. So there's a lot of tentacles to what Ramesh Panuro refers to as the culture of death. Mm-hmm. But I felt this way during COVID. I don't believe a society that celebrates the death of the unborn is in a moral position to lecture about the death of nightclubs or police shootings, or all these things. All of them are horrible for people who have the anthropology that you and I have. I can consistently stand behind an ethic of human life. But it doesn't seem to me that that is prevalent, that there's a real disdain for human life. And so therefore, people's various politicking around gun policy, I guess I don't take it super seriously.
Yeah, I almost didn't even want to talk about this story because you're right. Rinse and repeat. It just seems like we go through this every single time. And the left laments it in the same way that you and I are. Yes, it's always the same thing. But my own feeling is that until we address that sort of fundamental issue, the two main suspects right now, one of them's not even a suspect. He's sort of a key witness, if you will, but he's in police custody. I don't know how you even describe this. I'm sure the police have a term of art that I'm missing.
A person of interest?
Something like that. But even a person
of
interest.
If they're in custody, they're a suspect. I mean, you can't be in custody as a witness.
But the two guys.
Unless it's voluntary.
As of this morning, the two guys are from the same family, and one has to wonder, without wanting to cast aspersions on a family I've never met, how is it that two guys are involved in a massive, massive attack on, you know, otherwise unarmed civilians, it sounds like, you know, citizens in the coming out of these nightclubs. We've got an interesting story that I wanted to kind of do a quick compare and contrast. The incident is this. There was the expectation in Los Angeles at this community event over the weekend was, I'm sorry, it was like Friday, I believe, was that a social services organization was going to be handing out vouchers for Section 8 housing. And of course, homelessness, the cost of housing, loads of people showed up and were shocked to find out they weren't going to get vouchers. It was just kind of there to connect people to social services more than we're going to hand out vouchers or some sort of garbled communication there that had all these people show up. They got very frustrated. And as the story goes,
were they introverts? They didn't want to. They didn't want to mingle.
They didn't want to mingle. No, they were really ready to mingle. They were single and ready to mingle. And so, as the story goes, if you read the story that appears on ABC 7, that's the affiliate in LA, Congresswoman Maxine Waters stops to help hundreds who lined up expecting housing vouchers. And it's an amazing story. It includes a little bit of video of the congresswoman from LA showing up as she sees this, reportedly. I mean, she just sees this thing and orders her driver over, and she hops out. She gets onto a police, like a speaker in a police unit, and starts talking to the people who are getting pretty rowdy out there. Uh-huh. You have something to identify here already. Shall I continue?
I am going to lose my mind if you believe this story that she just happened to be driving by. Yeah. I'm telling you right now, it will end the podcast if you believe that bullshit, okay?
Here's my prize for one of the best stories maybe of the year thus far, because an LA Times reporter, and I want to use his name here because it's very good.
And she happened to have a microphone on her?
No, she went to the police unit that was already there. I guess some police had already
and asked to borrow their microphone.
Can I borrow your microphone? And they said, sure, Congresswoman. So she gets on the mic and she starts talking to people. So here's, you know, I read you the headline here from ABC.
Hey, Will, stay in front of the microphone there.
Well, it's me leaning
Maxine
over.
Maxine Waters can coach you on how to use a microphone.
So here's, the headline from ABC 7 is Congresswoman Maxine Waters stops to help hundreds who lined up expecting housing vouchers.
Uh-huh.
She said she believes more than half the people who came out may have been misinformed. I'm sorry, this is the Friday before. So this story is now a little over a week old, and I apologize for that, but it's still worth talking about because that's the headline here on ABC 7. And then a reporter named Connor Sheets over at the LA Times writes what I think is the greatest expose, the greatest counterpoint to that story. His headline is, LA's homelessness crisis boils over, pain, confusion, anger, and a congressional F-bomb. Same Maxine Waters, who's hailed as a saint for pulling over and helping, you know, alleviate all the anxiety and frustration in this crowd. This guy just really, here's the lead in his story. An unofficial social media post erroneously promised that those who showed up would get rare vouchers for permanent subsidized housing. They were swamped. Homeless people lined up on the corner of West Athens before daybreak on and Friday and Tuesday, only to have their hopes dashed. This is all last week, right? Heated arguments broke out among the hundreds who turned out for assistance. More evidence of the brutal LA housing market and desperation, blah, blah, blah. He has her showing up, that is Waters, who then says, look, you're not going to get Section 8 vouchers here. I want everybody to go home. I want homeless people she's talking to. I want everybody to go home, she says. The response was fast and angry. A voice from the crowd yelled, we don't got no home. That's why we're here. What home we going to go to? She laughs and says, look, nothing's going to happen here.
Would you say that a left-wing politician screaming to homeless people to go home is equivalent to when Joe Biden asked that disabled war veteran to stand up out of his wheelchair?
Yes, but also underreported. You could just imagine if Larry Elder had said this, right?
Oh, my God. Or anyone, Trump or Bush, yeah, or
right. Any
Will Swain. Right. I mean,
there you go.
Yeah.
So as people got
this story is driving me bonkers.
Well, it gets even better. The reporter says, jabbing her finger in the air, Waters said to this crowd, excuse me, there's nobody in Washington who works for their people any effing harder than I do. I don't want to hear this. No, no, no. That's what I do every day. The money that you got thus far, that came from me in Washington, D.C.
Dear
so here's
Lord.
This like personal ownership of federal taxpayer dollars saying that money came from me. Waters refused to talk to anybody about the story when the reporter called her. He said that's just a bunch of rumors. She requested the reporter not to write the story and told the reporter, you'll hurt yourself in the community trying to put this together without background. I don't want you to start trying to write it. You won't understand it.
Little threat.
Little bit of a threat. Yeah, you're going to hurt the community.
So what we have here is a sitting U.S. Congresswoman with a disdain for the First Amendment, who also believes that the money that comes out of Washington is hers.
Yes, I think you understand the story fully at this point.
There also seems to me to be traces of clinical narcissism, combined with a potty mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Combined with a complete and total lie in the other story about just happening to be driving by.
Right.
When, in fact, she had coordinated it with other people. You know what? I wonder if we need like a Maxine watch, like similar to the Kamala corner.
Yeah.
Because Maxine is a gift that keeps on giving. This person, she's psychotic.
I won't belabor this story any longer except to say that the reporter was able to contact her district director, a woman named Blanca Jimenez, who sent the reporter the email, a link to the story I just read from ABC7 in LA. And she said that someone shared this photo with the office. She means this video of Maxine Waters from the ABC7 story. And she writes, isn't she brave? There's your Maxine watch for the day. The Waters watch, or the Waters works. Hey, let's turn
another little thing that's kind of buried in the story that's totally anecdotal. I'm just wondering about the homeless person who saw about the event on Instagram.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What was that? Who was posting it on Instagram? What agency?
Well, this is the part that's really hard to get to. There's apparently that this story sort of blew up like the traditional fishing story. The fish got bigger. So this agency just said they were just putting out a message saying they were going to help with social services and connect people to housing. And it somehow got passed along through the homeless
grapevine.
Giving out the Section 8 vouchers. Yeah. Let's do a little bit of Gavin Newsom roundup here. There's a bunch of great stories. The first one I want to...
That's President Newsom to you.
Thank you, buddy. I don't know if you know this. He's on vacation right now. He's in Central and South America. Yeah.
I would like to go on record on Radio Free California, April 5th, 2022.
All right.
Gavin Newsom will be the Democrat nominee for president in 2024.
I think that's a safe bet.
I don't think it's safe. I mean, it's pretty contrarian, right? Like he's not the president, who is a Democrat, and he's not the vice president, who's a Democrat, and there's a whole bunch of others. But I think I'm standing behind this claim, and I do not think it's like the safe play. I think we're going on a limb here. What do you think? No?
No, I think absolutely the same thing. I mean, his State of the State, which we covered a few weeks ago, had this kind of call and response reference to what he called the California way. You might remember that. And he was talking about, you know, how we've solved homeless. That's the California way. We're stopping climate change. The California way. Yeah, he went through every single problem that ought to really just kill his candidacy, even for re-election this June and November, and somehow waved a wand and made it into something magical. Just a bald-faced lies. I mean, we fact-checked this whole thing on the show a few episodes back. It was just, you know, misrepresentation after misrepresentation, which he then headlined as the California way, which truly is. I think deception is the California way when it comes to our politics.
I still think, though, that what we've been covering and your points now and a lot of attention to what Gavin's been doing speak to his intent and his political objectives and the kind of underlying tactical agenda. I'm claiming it's going to work.
Yes.
I'm claiming that he will end up being the nominee.
I think you're absolutely right.
That will probably create a civil war in the Democratic Party, a metaphorical war. I normally don't like such metaphors, but they're common in politics, meaning a division between the intersectional, the woke, the identity politics brand, the people, the thinking that forced Joe Biden and cornered Joe Biden into picking Kamala Harris. You know, the situation that left us with the ultimate absurdity of the year, which was that Biden said, I have to pick a black woman to be on the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And then that black woman was unable to claim the definition of a woman, which really the question should have been reworded as, are you qualified to be Biden's choice?
Right.
Because he said it has to be a woman and you don't know what a woman is, ergo. So Newsom now as the definition of a white guy. Like, it just does not get more, like, boarding school, country club, white bread.
Yeah.
You know, just this guy, you know, let's put it this way. He wasn't jumping out of his car in L.A. to go deal with Section 8 housing, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I think Gavin is a really good candidate for the Dems in terms of his youth and looks and charisma or whatever. Not really youth. He's not young, but he's younger than this mold they've had of running, you know, 70, mid-70 septuagenarian candidates. I think that the white male thing is just going to, I just don't know how they're going to pull it off. I really don't. And
you don't know how they're going to pull off running a white guy?
Look, the entire energy of the party is gone, for right or for wrong, into wokeism and into condemning white privilege and into extracting it. Gavin Newsom, I don't believe in the terminology of white privilege, but if I did, he's it. Right? And in every way, shape, or form, he is a beneficiary of class and of position and of being in the right place, right time, and from all kinds of circumstances. And I just don't know in 2024 if they're going to go shoot a black woman in the face metaphorically, which is what we talk about every week as to what they're doing to Kamala Harris, undermining her political future, and then replace this black woman with a white male and Gavin Newsom. I think it's going to be utterly fascinating, but I do think they're going to do it. I do think it'll work. I do think he'll end up being the nominee. And I think that's a risky bet.
Wow, it's funny. I must be, you know, it probably tells you who I'm traveling with. You know, my own media bubble is, you're right. That just seems to me self-evident. It seems like the best bet that one could make right now. Let's talk about how he might finagle this, of course, is because he does so much virtue signaling. I'm going to skip down a few stories here, David, on our list. Under dumb California laws, remember that it's Newsom who signs into law. This is from the New York Times. A Assembly Bill 979, which went into effect in 2020. We talked about this at the time. This was the bill requiring that publicly traded companies in California must have board members from, quote, underrepresented communities, including people of several races and ethnic groups and people who identify as gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender. Newsom claimed it, proclaimed it a victory for racial justice and empowerment at the time. You and I both predicted this will not stand constitutional muster. Here it is. California law requiring board diversity is struck down in a blow to the state's efforts to deal with disparities in the workplace. A judge, this is a California Superior Court judge, found the law unconstitutional. Unclear whether the state will appeal. So when you have bad advice or just a conniving and ambitious sort of politician, as is Gavin Newsom, you go ahead and you pass these kinds of laws requiring diversity in a way that is clearly unconstitutional. I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but it even struck me that this thing wasn't going to survive. It did you as well. So here it is. In response to a lawsuit brought by Judicial Watch, good on you, Judicial Watch, Judge Terry Green of Los Angeles County Superior Court on Friday, this past Friday, April 1st, found the law violated the state constitution. And I think the judge's comments are really worth citing, and the New York Times does. It says here, if demographically homogeneous boards are a problem, homogeneous boards are a problem, then heterogeneous boards are the immediate and obvious solution, he wrote. But that doesn't mean the legislature can skip directly to mandating heterogeneous boards. He also described the law as a bit arbitrary as to which groups it aimed to help in an earlier hearing. He said that.
Did you catch this other line? The California Partners Project, yes, called the decision, this is a determination from a judge.
Yeah.
And he said, well, this is disappointing, but not determinative.
That's right. I love that. The group pointed to studies, right? So a judge just told you it's unconstitutional. They responded by saying that there are studies that show business outcomes are better, quote, when all of our rich talent is represented in positions of leadership, and noted that investors motivated by these outcomes will continue to pressure companies to have diverse boards. That is through that what you have, I think, appropriately called DIE, diversity, inclusion, and equity. How will Gavin Newsom snake his way through to 2024 as a very white Abercrombie and Fitch guy? He will do it by continuing to signal these kinds of things and then say the sorts of populist things that are required to explain why these things fail, which is the courts were in our way, right? This is just so self-evident that we need to have this law mandate. It's such a good idea that we have to make it a mandate. I think that's how he's going to do it. Everything is about the virtue with this guy. Same thing with oil. Let's go to the next story under Newsom. And that's this is from a friend I just met. He is a very good guy. His name is Ron Stein. He is an energy exec. Used to work with, I don't think I'm revealing anything here. He used to work with the Fluor Corporation. Of course, they build massive utility projects around the world. He still works in energy adjacent business. The headline here is Newsom's energy regulations have oil tankers emitting more than twice what all of California's vehicle fleet emit. And I won't go through the whole study except to say that because we have shut down oil refining domestically, not just in the U.S. generally, but in California specifically, we have to import oil from other places. And we do that through tankers. And tankers themselves are among, this guy points out, the most noxious polluters on the planet. When they are running on the lowest form of crude. It's far worse than diesel. They're all over the ocean all the time, and they're importing into California all the oil that we must refine here because we won't drill it ourselves and keep it local, right? So we have these tankers coming in from Saudi Arabia or everywhere else. And he points out that the amount of bunker fuel, that is the peculiar crude oil leftover that ships run on, it's as thick as tar, you can walk on this stuff when it's not heated up, that is so polluting. It emits twice the carbon of all of California's vehicles in a year. So this is the trade-off. Your book is all about no free lunch, and the governor is constantly telling us, yes, there is, that we can wipe out oil production in California and make the planet cleaner. All he's doing is shifting the pollution offshore into these cargo tankers, these cargo container ships, not containers, I'm sorry, these whatever you call them, container ships, cargo ships. So there it is. I'll post that in the show notes so that people can read it for themselves. But I think it's, again, just that crazy mismatch between the virtue signal of we can have 100% clean energy, which he constantly uses as a phrase. There's no such thing. And then we end up polluting far more and having higher oil prices anyway. In another fascinating story, we've got the governor saying that he wants a ban on watering decorative grass, that is grass around industrial and commercial centers. No more grass that can be watered. He's going to start fining businesses if he can get this regulation through. And it's ironic because our own organization here, California Policy Center, our guy Ed Ring, has a piece in National Review on your favorite Capital Matters section of the National Review. And it's a story called Why California Must Fund Water Infrastructure Upgrades. And David, I should have asked you to read this like over the weekend. One of Ed's major points is that we have people who are now benefiting financially from supporting water scarcity. There was an attempt on our part as an organization to put together an initiative that would have required the speedy processing of permits to produce more abundant water. That is, more reservoirs, more creekside, stream runoff collection, you name it. We haven't built a dam, I think, in 41 years in this state, or a reservoir of any significance. And this would say, look, enough is enough. We need to create more abundant water. If you don't have abundant water in California, you kill people. Like, this threatens the lives of Californians. Literally, there are people now who are running short on water.
So, Will, what's the working theory from you and Ring and others as to why? Why do they not want to build more water infrastructure?
Well, the key is environmentalists, number one. Okay. Ed's point, and he has some really interesting evidence if you look at the story. He says there are significant interests that are financing environmental objections to water. And these are people including the Harvard Endowment, Saudi investors, and then some groups I've never heard of. Maybe you know them. He lists Trinitas Partners, LGS Holdings, Greenstone, and other out-of-state investment firms and hedge funds buying out California's financially stressed farmers and ranchers. And their profit model relies on water scarcity. Now, this is almost a Marxist argument, right? This is almost like, oh, you got capitalism run amok, and these people are investing in a way that is going to limit water production and water abundance. So I'm asking you, without knowing all the details necessarily of all of Ed's evidence, just hearing what I've just told you, what do you make of, like, what's your shoot from the hip kind of hot take on this, or maybe not a hot take? What do you think of the problem? Ed says, it's reasonable to ask why we shouldn't just let the market take its natural course and let the price of water rise until there's an equilibrium between supply and demand.
I totally agree with that. And I think that the question, I want the other side to answer what their aversion to expansion of water infrastructure is. I believe you are right that it is environmental extremism. But I think they need to be cornered into admitting such, because I believe that the sane world, which is not limited to just ideological conservatives, sort of regular people that are reasonably apolitical, deserve to know. Just like right now, we're living in a time where people deserve to know that they're paying $6 at the fuel pump because we made a decision over the years to curtail U.S. production. We made a decision to be a slave to global markets that are largely controlled by unfriendly actors when we have the capacity not to be. But that trade-off was made because we decided with the environmental extremists. When it comes to water infrastructure in California, the various bad things that are not just cost-oriented, but eventually rationing and other elements that are, you know, obviously quite painful for people, that happened during droughts and so forth, I think people need to know where it came from. Now, they may say, okay, now that I know it's environmentalist and we're really saving the world by not building new dams or not investing in our you know, resources and structural needs, they may decide it's a good thing. But of course, I happen to believe they won't. But either way, this argument needs to be pushed all the way to its conclusion. And we're living in insane times about this. And California, this is going to require leadership. And I don't think it has to be from an ideological conservative. There has to be a pragmatic Democrat that comes on and just sort of has like that moment where, you know, there's still some on the left that realize we need natural gas, and there's still like Rahm Emanuel's, and even Lori Lightfoot got to the point where Chicago school districts of like, God, these people are ruining our schools. There has to be someone who says, okay, I'm an environmentalist, I'm a leftist, but you know what? This is a bridge too far, and people are dying. And it is unsafe and ill-advised to continue what amounts to an anti-water policy. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm anti some things and I'm pro some things, but I'm not anti-water. As a matter of fact, I'm going to have a sip right now.
Put that on the record. Okay, so one last thing on the Gavin Newsom watch here.
I've never seen you drink water. I've seen you spit water all over, but not necessarily drink it. But I see it now. You know what? Lately you've been coming to the office with a mocha.
I did that one time, and I do like a mocha.
I know, but I think you did it more than one time. I don't usually make fun of people. No, I'm a pretty good water drinker. You a good water drinker?
Oh, all the time. Gallons.
Yeah. Got to stay hydrated.
Stay hydrated, baby. Hey, just I want to run through this story really quickly, but Newsom's Pacific Gas and Electric bailout law. He famously signed off on a law that he actually helped draft, his staff helped to draft, in response to PG&E's crimes. I mean, PG&E was convicted of manslaughter in a bunch of Northern California fires. I just want to take time to footnote the fact that PG&E and other utilities, major utilities in California, are highly regulated, among the most highly regulated industries in California. Regulated through the Public Utilities Commission. So arguing that somehow they are uniquely, individually responsible for wildfires when their infrastructure breaks down ignores the fact that the state has interests other than stopping wildfires when it regulates PG&E, namely, make sure we stop gas production, fossil fuels, gas, the use of natural gas, and make sure that we switch to solar. So all of PG&E's money that might be used to harden, or much of it that might be used to harden its infrastructure, was used instead to pursue, I think, utopian dreams of a 100% clean energy system. So that company, PG&E, declared bankruptcy, right? And Newsom wanted a bailout law that would help them escape, you know, get out of bankruptcy cleanly. And so he hired a firm to help draft that, a law firm, O'Melveny & Myers. And that law firm that helped draft the bill that made it through the state legislature and which Newsom signed to bail out PG&E, that same law firm, was a law firm for PG&E just months before they drafted this bill to bail out their former client. Both O'Melveny and Myers and the governor laugh at the idea that there's any kind of conflict of interest here or even an apparent conflict of interest. They will not acknowledge this. It's just a fascinating story again of the kind of pay to play in the Newsom administration. So anywho, let's move on. I want to ask you really about the news of the day, which is that Elon Musk bought a 9% stake in Twitter, and shares of Twitter went up dramatically. Conservatives are hailing this as an opportunity, to get Twitter back on the right track of real free speech. David, do you have any thoughts at all about Twitter and Elon Musk?
Yeah, so the story has evolved since then. 24 hours after that announcement came out, and so Elon did tweet it out, but it was also a requirement with his filings with the SEC. When you take that significant of an ownership interest, he has now been invited onto the board of Twitter. And the CEO, who he previously, Musk, had apparently sent a tweet meme kind of thing out with indicating, basically referencing this new CEO who replaced Jack Dorsey was like Stalin. And now that CEO has tweeted out this morning that can't wait to have Elon on, and he's going to bring so much value, and we really want to be able to interact with him. And so I actually think Twitter is handling it really cleverly in the sense of Musk was ready to go all scorched earth.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect them accommodating him. For one thing, now with a seat on the board, he's limited to acquiring more than 14.9% of the shares. You can't be a 15% or greater shareholder with that board status. And so there were people that thought he was prepping the thing to do a takeover of the entire company. No one knows exactly what he's thinking, but this is the part I guess we can say. It's more likely to create some good outcome than not. I don't know exactly what the outcome will be, what his end run is. He's a very thoughtful guy. I want to be careful, too, because right now we're all pretty happy with Musk. I've been pretty happy with him since COVID, you know, when he really fought back against the idiocies of the state legislator, California, when he voted with his feet to leave, when he stood his ground about being able to reopen when they were pulling authoritarian tricks to keep people shut down. I think Musk is generally a kind of classical liberal, a free speech, you know, kind of guy, free press, that type of stuff. He's, you know, quite climate change minded. He's very good friends with a lot of the folks. You know, he was one of the co-founders of PayPal. And there's a kind of eclectic group that came out of that PayPal origin, including Pete Thiel. So you get a little bit more of a libertarian DNA sometimes that doesn't fit into either a conservative or liberal bucket. But I like Musk. As far as corporate CEOs go, he has far less interest in playing the game of popularity than many do. But what exactly happens here remains to be seen. But I do think Twitter saying we're not going to get into a brawl with him. We're not going to come out and resist his ownership. I think they realized he had the muscle to continue acquiring shares. That can lead to proxy fights. This is what Carl Icahn's done his whole life. He gets in brawls in the boardroom, and I barely ever see the guy lose one. And now Twitter is kind of avoiding a brawl by playing nice in the sandbox with Elon Musk. It's probably a smart move.
Yeah, I wonder, can you help me make sense of this one point in, where was the story? I think this is MSNBC. The story says the Musk buy, let me see, where is it? Here we go. Late last month, Musk also said he was considering building a new social media platform. Is that like a shot across the bow of Twitter saying like, look, you know, I'm going to come in, and if you guys don't let me come in, is it conceivable, in other words, this was the predicate to his purchase?
Well, I think that he's been frustrated with the kind of anti-liberal, the illiberal corporate policies of Twitter. And by here, I mean liberal in the right way, the way that the word used to be used before we conservatives freely gave the word up. I think Musk has been turned off by the illiberal policies at Twitter that have denied a voice and denied speech and forced people to say they were sorry for things they weren't sorry for. And by the way, a lot more often in the culture war than the political war, the biggest censorships I've seen with Twitter have come to transgender-oriented issues and people not using the right pronouns and other things like that more often. Now, the Hunter Biden thing was another massive case where, again, that whole story could have been a joke or it could have been legit. Mm-hmm. And it could have, you know, maybe there are people out there that would have voted for either Trump or Biden based on what Hunter did with crack cocaine or not. I don't know. It's kind of hard for me to put myself in those shoes of saying, like, before I vote, I need to know, you know, what Hunter's up to. But it doesn't matter because there's some people that wanted to know what's going on. And even if we didn't have all the info, it's simply unfathomable that the New York Post running a story that was obviously a legitimate news story and has since all been confirmed. But even before it was all fully confirmed, it was in the public square. And Twitter took all of that down. Mm-hmm. So those things set Elon off. Now, forming a substitute Twitter, it hasn't gone well so far. But in fairness, the people that have tried to do it don't have the muscle of Elon Musk, the tech savvy, let alone the capital base. And so my belief that it's not been a great play so far with Parler and with, what is it, Gutter or Getter or something?
Getter. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of these things out there that are kind of MAGA oriented. They haven't really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not, and you go there and it's just like, oh my God, I can't even imagine someone spending any time there. But the fact of the matter is Musk has something going on. He's a strategic guy. And I think we'll all enjoy watching how this plays out.
Do you have time for a couple more stories? How's your time look?
I don't have time for anything more, but I'm going to do whatever you say, Will.
All right. Well, I just want to look at a couple more stories. The most important one of which I think here in the at the bottom of the list, but not because it's not important. We talked a lot about the National School Board Association working with the Department of Education and the Justice Department under Merrick Garland to target parents as domestic terrorists. You might remember that whole debacle back in October. And what we, you know, ultimately found out, of course, is that this was coordinated between the National School Board Association and its largest member, the California School Board Association, which sent a similar letter. California School Board Association is part of the National. And the National and California worked with the Biden administration to produce this outcome of let's get the FBI deployed to go investigate unruly parents who are ticked off about critical race theory and gender fluidity stuff in the curriculum, as well as just school lockdowns. Parents are starting to show up. This is what led to Glenn Youngkin winning the governor's race, many people believe, in Virginia. So then after that revelation, and a lot of people helped drive this, National Review was all over it, Caroline Downey, who did some terrific reporting. After that revelation that all this stuff had just been monkey business and shenanigans, and the California School Board Association, I want to point out, did the same thing here in the state of California. They sent a letter to the governor and a letter to Rob Bonta, and they asked both of them to deploy state police on parents who were getting too rambunctious at school board meetings. They said they had never seen anything like this. They were terrified of the parents. Well, states started dropping out of the National School Board Association with great rapidity. I think it's now about 17 states have dropped out. Their state school board associations have dropped out of the national organization. California let the other shoe drop, and it just announced yesterday that it's out. It's dropping out of the National School Board Association. And this is a kind of almost a fatal blow to the national organization. California is easily the largest, wealthiest school board group in that organization. There are about like 1,100 school districts in California, and many of them belong to this state organization. The state organization pays dues to the national. My point is, lots of taxpayer money flowing through these school districts so they can belong to a leftist organization called the California School Board Association. Now the California School Board Association says it's out. And it's out for two reasons. Number one, because the national doesn't represent California politics accurately or adequately in Washington. So California is now going to open up its California School Board Association will now open up its own lobbying organization, its own office in Washington, D.C. to make sure that California impulses, proclivities, policy initiatives, you name it, its politics are lobbied for aggressively in the U.S. Capitol. And I talked to a spokesperson from the CSBA yesterday who said, look, it's now clear that even if they could do this, if the National School Board Association could represent our interests in our, and I would argue our radical interests, he didn't say that, of course, those are my words, not his. Even if they wanted to, they can't now because all these other states have dropped out. There's just not enough cash going to the national organization, enough taxpayer cash. Again, this is not private money. This is public money being paid in the form of membership dues by local school boards to belong to this organization. So these are your tax dollars at work in your local school district. It is entirely possible and therefore likely that your school district still belongs to the California School Board Association is using its money to shut down parents who are upset about what's going on in their schools. This is an anti-democratic, small d, anti-democratic organization. It is hostile to free speech. It's hostile to public participation in school board governance. And this is their run around the national organization. They conspired with them, I would say, to shut parents down through threats of FBI and police intervention. And now the California group has taken advantage of the weakness of their larger association to sort of run its own game in D.C. So more of that to come. And lots more stories we could get to here, David, but I know we're short on time. So anything else you want to talk about here before we wrap up?
You prepared well again, my friend. Great show, great content, great stories, great efforts to reclaim California.
Thank you, buddy. Good to see you. I miss your company. And when are you going to be back out here again? Week after next, maybe?
Yeah, after I'll come back Good Friday. And oh, so sweet. then I'll be back for the second half of April.
Good Friday sounds like a great day for a party. It's so good, right? I kid. That's all the time we have today for blasphemy. I apologize. You can always find this podcast on the National Review website, but it's easier for you and better for us if you just subscribe. And of course, rate and review the show wherever you do subscribe. Please email us with your comments and story suggestions. That's where I get so many of these great story ideas. You'll find our personal email addresses and other fun details in the show notes. You can also follow us on Twitter at the Radio Free CA. On behalf of my friend and co-host David Bonson, we give thanks as ever to show producer Sarah Schutte, our engineers Brian Tong and Glenn Hall, and all of our friends at National Review. Thanks also to Metalachi, the LA-based mariachi metal band, for our music. La Revolución continúa en la semana próxima. We'll be right back.